Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is writer, poet, radio artist, performer, actor, director, and original member of the Firesign Theater, David Ossman. David, it's such a pleasure to talk to you again. I really had to talk with you again because, you know, we talked first about, you know, Firesign Theater and the new material that's out. Well, the newly released material. But then the more I started to read your other stuff, other than necessarily the Firesign Theater stuff, I realized you had a lifetime devoted to the oral arts, A-U-R-A-L. And I wanted to talk to you about it. And I want to start with a really old project that you did, and I picked up the copy of The Sullen Art. Talk to me about that that project, because I was amazed what went on in this.
Well, that's kind of the start of a lot of things, The Sullen Art. My first real job, certainly my first job in radio, was at WBAI in New York. It was a commercial station when I signed on as a summer replacement announcer. And about, well, at the end of the summer, as a matter of fact, January 1st, 1960, it was given, the station was given over by its owner, a nice guy who made cigarette paper, as I recall, and donated it to the Pacifica Foundation, where it became the third of their stations, KPFA in Berkeley, KPFK in Los Angeles, which was only about a year old then, and BAI. And I was at that point, I'm 23 years old, 20, something like that, early 20s. So, and I'm very engaged in one part of my life in the poetry circle that is not the Upper West Side poetry circle, but the Lower East Side poetry circle. And I had friends. I had been sending out poems since I was 16, okay, to be published one place or another. And so, like anything else, here were all these great new magazines. Everybody was coming out with a magazine. And so I sent material in and met the editors, read at the readings at the 10th Street Coffee House, and was totally involved. So the station manager, I had never done any other thing other than this was called a combo op. You manage the board, you play the records, you do the announcements, you read the news, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And so I said, well, I know all these guys. You know, can I do an interview series with these people? Can I interview them? And he said, oh, sure, go right ahead. So I got myself a half-hour slot. And let's see, you know.
I have the print version. And I want to recommend that there is a print version that reproduced a few of the poets that you interviewed. Okay, and it's called The Sullen Art 2. The lineup of this is outstanding. I mean, there's people like Leroy Jones, Allen Ginsberg, Kenneth Rexroth.
Well, here's the whole thrust. If you go, because I did about 50 interviews.
Yeah, yeah.
And at that moment, which is late 60 going into 61, I interviewed Allen on like the 22nd of December. Okay? His interview is really the center of what was going on because everybody was waiting for Allen's new book, which hadn't come out. Powell was 5 years old. What was he going to do next? I mean, it was a huge presence. And everyone that I talked to talked about Allen, A. B. Otherwise, you know, one way or another, some people, you know, you didn't like what was going on in the beat world at all. And so I did 50 of these interviews. In the first book, the Corinth publication, there's a dozen. And that was part of my, you know, my world, Corinth Press. They did that book, and it was at the same time that I had another book of poetry published. And so I'm very much engaged in that literary world in New York at that time. And needless to say, because everything was very chaotic, I left with all of my tapes.
Good move, David. Good move.
Good move. And at the end of 60, about halfway through, just after I'd interviewed Allen, I did my first documentary, you know, cutting tape together, you know, and trying to present, as I saw it at that moment, the state of American poetry as of January 1961. So that way, and I'm 24.
Okay, this is what freaks me out. Okay, this is wait. As a person who interviews people, this is what freaks me out, because your questions that you ask these poets were brilliant. They were really well done questions. What are you, like a interviewer savant or something? I mean, that was like amazing.
Well, I knew the world, you see.
Yeah.
That was it. I was a friend of many of...
Most people don't know how to interview poets.
Yeah.
And you were right in there with the questions that counted. And I'm not just saying that to make you feel good. But as another interviewer, when I read this, I went, holy crap. You know, this is amazing. And the funny thing is the information that comes out in these interviews is wild. You learn that Allen Ginsberg is a worry wart. That alone is worth the price of admission.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's just the Allen's interview to me is just like at a classic moment.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody is looking at what the 60s are going to be. And everybody knows that Allen Ginsberg is going to be a major part of it, whatever it is he does next. And so it was, and so it happened. But I think, Leroy Jones, I was published in The Floating Bear, which was his and Diane DePrima's Mimeo magazine. I mean, it was right there inside of all of this. And it was important then to communicate even a little bit of this information. The first book, you know, is like 12 interviews. The new publication, which I spent years trying to convince the University of Toledo to publish, because I sold the tape collection to them. But would they publish a book? No, years and years until they finally got a new editor, and she said that might be interesting. And I said, I think so. Marjorie Perloff, who is the expert, she was Judith, my wife's professor at USC. She's the authority. Marjorie is on the Beat era, and her review was, this is an essential book.
Yeah.
That made me feel really good that I'd done something that was essential, you know?
Well, it's such a documentary of poetry at that time, and there's a point made. It's not just beats and whatever that means to different people. It was really that whole scene that was going on at that time.
Yeah, I mean, W.S. Merwin. I mean, there were people totally outside of anything. They would be in town, and I had helped. Paul Blackburn was a big help in booking people.
And the people's
they would come through town and say, well, you know, there's this radio program. Oh, really? Okay. And they'd call me up and say,
let's
do an interview. So the fact that there aren't more women in here is unfortunate. I mean, there are Barbara Mora, for heaven's sake, Rochelle Owens, you know, Margaret Randall. Margaret's still very, very active. Denise Levertov, you know, and she was extremely helpful in pointing poets who came into New York my way. Couldn't have done it without, you know, those people saying, you know, Osmond's interviewing. Go and do it.
Well, you know,
just even a poetry reading. You don't want to talk, just read your poetry.
You're the person at the moment in the right spot. You write that the general public viewed poets at that time, and this is a quote, as a bunch of illiterate, barbaric, slightly criminal types.
Yeah, true enough. So, but before that, since my high school years, I had been sending poetry out, writing and sending poetry out. And that continued through that time. And then at the end, in the fall of 61, just before New York happened, you know, I moved to KPFK in Los Angeles, where absolutely nothing was happening. It was amazing. God, what a desert It was.
But was that a good thing? Because that means anything you could come up with would be new and fresh?
I think you've seized the day. Yeah, exactly. You know, and I'd come from New York where we were reviewing play openings.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, people were in and out of very important people. That's VIP. People were coming in and out of that station all the time, you know? I mean, it was New York, so obviously there they were. They could get on the air. In Los Angeles, there was the movie business. Let me see. What else was there? there was the Hollywood Bowl, which was very good. It was a great place to grow up, with the Hollywood Bowl and the Greek Theater. But culturally, man, it was still Alfred Wallenstein and the Los Angeles Philharmonic. I mean, you know, it was. So if you had a book that you had just published and you wanted to be interviewed about it on the radio, where were you going to go? KTLA? No, you were going to go to KPFK, where somebody would know what you were talking about. So,
wow.
So that really was the case in the early 60s. It was surely reflected the liberal Quakerism of the founders of Pacifica. It was much less dominated by local talent than KPFA. We were very reluctant to give our time away or to give someone a program that you then couldn't get out of. So essentially for about 3 years, I programmed the station. We had every 2 weeks during that time, we had a program guide that was detailed, you know, 10 words on every program. And there were 10 or 15 programs a day, you know, a music concert, a lecture, a music concert, a documentary, a BBC program, you know. It was huge. It was a huge thing. And so that's where I developed, within the context of that kind of radio, which was foundational FM radio at very beginning, to have an eclectic programming that was basically music, talk, alternating.
Wow.
But beginning to produce a lot of shows inside house. I was literature and drama director, which means I got to produce plays, review books, had a series of actually a book review program. I tried to remember what it was called.
Well,
it had a funny name.
But David, at the end of Marshmallows in Despair, which is a more recent collection of poetry that you wrote, you talk about that you corresponded with Jean Cocteau.
Yes, well, I was an art history minor and pretty much a French minor in college. So,
Well, you spoke with Marcel Duchamp?
Yeah.
That's like...
Yeah, I mean, not much, but I shook his hand.
He didn't say a lot to anybody. So
that's very true. Right. That was when he was in Pasadena and had that photograph with Eve Babbitt.
Oh, yeah.
Playing naked chess, you know?
He's literally the reason I became an artist was Marcel Duchamp. But Jean Cocteau, when I think about Orphée, the testament of Orphée, Beauty and the Beast, Sang the Poet, when I started realizing that you were influenced by people like Duchamp and Cocteau, all of a sudden the impetus for Firesign Theater makes a lot more sense.
Well, yes, we all brought, the four of us brought almost entirely different things to the Firesign Theater. On the things that we all agreed on, the Goon Show, for example.
Yep.
You know, we all had that. Phil spoke Russian fluently, spoke French, had traveled to Russia with the Yale Russian Chorus, and in fact, had a pretty privileged life up to the point that we were together. Had grown up in the East, seen a lot of Broadway shows, certainly as many as I had, being close in age, had worked as a professional actor since he was a boy. Very experienced, but in terms of growing up, I grew up in Los Angeles in a cottage. My parents went to India when I was 18, and I lived on my own for the rest of that time. Became an adult very quickly, I should say, as much as an adult you can become in your 20s or even 30s. And so that, you know, so what I brought was that sort of, was that French thing, okay? Was that from Baudelaire to, yeah, to Sartre, you know? Peter brought, you know, we all came with a little bit of Waiting for Godot. But I think it was probably more important to me and Peter than it was to the Phils, in terms of influence, in terms of what kind of theater we were going to do. Remember, you know, Peter said, shall I call you the Firesign Theater, which meant from the very beginning we were a theater, which requires you to do a lot of things, you know. You've got to write plays, and then put them on, and if you want to, you got to wear costumes, and you got to blah, blah, blah. So being a theater... And as I always say, without, you know, what we did was right. We were very fortunate to hit the market at a point
where we
performed what we wrote.
Yeah, this new release of Firesign Theater material, which is called Dope Humor of the 70s, I sort of was taken aback by that, because to this day, when I listen to things like Don't Crush That Dwarf, Pass Me the Pliers, or Everything You Know Is Wrong, or any of the other great albums, it was, to me, always more than that. And as a matter of fact, I get more out of that now than I did then, because it was funny, for sure. But it was a different thing. It created entire worlds. It created entire realities. It created entire sensibilities. I think it was a lot more than just dope humor. I mean, for you at the time, what
this was it? You know, did I title it "Dope Humor of the 70s"? No, I didn't.
I didn't think you did.
No.
And it never was that at the time, though, was it? It could be influenced by. I totally get that.
Well, there's also the dope meaning good, great.
Yep.
Dope humor.
Okay.
So
okay.
There's another meaning for it.
All right, I'll accept that. But today, listening to these recordings with fresh ears, it's really funny. I was playing them for my older grandchildren who are in their teens. It freaks them out. Well, it's like, first of all, it's too much, too fast. And it's like they just think it's so much more bizarre than anything they're used to. Then it made a lot of sense, because we were sort of onto that sort of surrealist tip. But it's really funny today. It's really scary surrealist.
It's Beat the Reaper. Everybody went back to Beat the Reaper, which was virtually, you know, like one of the first things we ever wrote. And like, it was the return of Beat the Reaper year, that was for sure. You know, and we're not insane. We've been on the political...
Oh, my God. Everything You Know Is Wrong is very apropos right now.
That would too. You bet. And also, how can you be in two places at once? But you know.
Wait a minute. Let me do an ID. Okay. You're listening to WIC at 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is writer, poet, radio artist, performer, actor, director, and original member of the Firesign Theater, David Ausman. And we're here to talk about all sorts of other parts in your career. Before we do that, David, can I impose on you to read a poem from Marshmallows in Despair?
Well, sure. What? Let's not see. Marshmallows in Despair was the most recent two books,
yep,
essentially. But the thing that is unique about this is that it contains poems which are also commercials. Now, you may think that's strange, but if you listen to the Firesign Theater,
that's right,
you wouldn't be surprised to know that many of the pieces just simply play like poems. So I'll be happy to read this one. This was written as a commercial and as a poem at the same time. Once again, for the flavored few, the New World Mint trots out a delectable collectively collectible selection of six handsomely hand-molded chief executive posteriors in pure 24-carat oil-fed creamery butter. Purchase your personal thank you, Mr. President's prize package right away today, and we'll bend over the moon to show you a Four Cheeks for Two New World deal you can have as long as they last. That's right. We'll ship out your very first sofa-size send-up of our New World Mint Julius and self-tossed Caesar, the W. Bush Jr. Butterbutt, with a slick, kissable Texas cookout finish in pretzel tan that smirks like a million points of friendly fire. Then choose your choice of dads. Try out the unlovable loser of the united, unevil umpire, the lesser elder George H.W. Butterbutt. Some folks think that a daily fat pat on a tight bush brings fortunes to lucky fingers fast and on the inside. Or why not pick up on the prickly ex-people's choice? Express yourself, Pops, with the Hop on Pop Prexy's coccyx, still frozen in FedEx's X-Truck, and extra finely struck out, the way you'll always want to think about watching him, laid low and inside, spread wide, suitable for getting framed. Kiss up today to presidential butts in butter from the New World Mint, where our wildest dreams are made of fat.
That just made my month.
Yeah, I wrote that. So many things, so many poems that I wrote after, you know, when the fire sign was on the radio. You know, that was my publishing point at that point. Lots of poems on Dear Friends and Let's yeah. Eat. And with Peter when we were doing the Radio Free Oz, you know, these more the kind of political poem, the opposite of this book, or let me say the other side of Marshmallows and Despair, is a book called The Old Man's Poems, which are very reflective, very spare, the other kind of writing that I do. These are much more political.
Yeah.
I am caught up in another kind of moment of time. So,
can I ask you about writing poetry? Because we're going to run out of time.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah, but that's okay. Do you write every day? Do you write every week? Or do you only write when it suddenly hits you?
Tough question, depending upon what historical moment you happen to be in.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, 50 years, you know, I always had a notebook. A three-ring binder that was the latest poetry book, always had a poetry book in work, always. And that really is the same thing is true. I write a lot less now, partly because I've written a great, great deal.
Yeah.
And poetry is a very specific place to go. There are different places to go as a writer, you know, and the place, if you can't write anything at all, I've done a lot of collages, you know what I mean? I mean, it's you got to put things together, whether they're words or images or figures. I'm actually having a good time on Facebook.
Huh.
Why? Because I can post something and it gets people going.
That's right.
And if I choose carefully, I'm learning to choose what I post. Wow, bang, all of a sudden, 105 responses, you know, over an issue that is not being political, not being fire sign, just being illustrative, you know.
Yep.
Here's a picture of an electric car from 1912, you know, electric car 120 years ago. Think about it, okay? just that kind of little thing. So that, you know, I wrote a great deal over a period of about 5 or 6 years. You know, both the second novel, the memoir, all kinds of introductory material for all the Firesign releases, which ought to be all bundled.
And you also, there's a whole George Tirebiter mythos. I read the Ronald Reagan murder case, which that's like you've created an entire being.
Yes. You know, I wrote to Phil Proctor just today. I said, sometimes I feel like old George and young Porgy at the same time.
Spring Byington really... and Broderick Crawford.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to remember December Bride. So.
Yes. Well, Broderick Crawford was one of our very favorites. Spring Buying.
Oh, my God. Broderick Crawford.
Yeah.
I was just watching a rerun of Highway Patrol, which is on the Ziv. What was a Ziv production?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. Leaning against the car because he couldn't stand
That's
up.
That's right.
Oh, yeah. Great.
But you've also done a tremendous amount of stage productions and radio dramas, often written and produced with Judith Walcott.
That's right. Since we were together about 35 years ago now, we started doing large-scale radio theatrical productions, radio drama, audio theater, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
And, we did, the first thing we did together was The Red Badge of Courage.
We're completely out of time, by the way. But you did The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which I wanted to get to. You did It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes, on stage live. Tremendous amount of work. Now, there's no theater. There's no audience. There's no place to go sit down. There's nowhere to do your stuff. It's really tough.
It is really tough. And everybody's hurting. Hopefully, there's light at the end of the tunnel here. Although I have yet to get my vaccine.
Yeah, so. I'm supposed to be in line for it.
Right, as we speak. and he's not getting his vaccine because he's doing this interview because that's the kind of guy he is. David, we could be talking for another hour. You have so much that you've done. Are you going to write another memoir maybe?
Well, you know, I've been trying to figure out how to approach that. My publisher says, how's the writing coming, you know?
Just say yes, and we'll end it here because I'll hold up a hope that you're going to do another one.
Yeah, I don't think I could do another.
No, I don't want to hear that.
No. But a memoir, maybe.
Okay, my returning guest tonight has been writer, poet, radio artist, performer, actor, director, memoirist, original member of the Firesign Theater, David Ostman. David, it's been a distinct pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Mark. Talking to you about, other than the Firesign Theater, about my kind of poetry life, I love that. Thank you.
Oh, man, and I want to talk about your theater life. That could be for another time.
Okay.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.